Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is David Vann, whose latest novel is Dirt. David Vann is also the author of Legend of a Suicide and Caribou Island. Unlike Legend of a Suicide and Caribou Island, both of which are set in Alaska, this one is set in California, and it's set in 1985, and it concerns a young man, his mother, and his aunt and cousin. There's actually a fifth character, a grandmother with Alzheimer's. But it's essentially a four-character story. And before we went on the air, I mentioned to you that it seemed like a long, short story because it's very focused, and there aren't too many places where it could go. Is that pretty much how you were working on it from the start?
Yeah, this came much closer to being a Greek tragedy than anything I've written before, with just those four characters, as you said, and a little bit of a fifth, mostly in two locations over about 10 days. It was unconscious when I was writing. I had no outline or plan. I didn't know what it would be. I didn't know what it would be about. So these weren't choices necessarily, but when I look back, it seems inevitable that I would end up telling the story and that it would probably take a compressed form because it's based on the second short story I ever wrote. Which was about this material, this place, and the history of the grandparents. And it's based on a place I know well from my childhood, my grandparents' place in Carmichael in Sacramento.
How far outside of Sacramento is it?
It's really just in the suburbs. It's actually part of Sacramento. But they had 10 acres of walnuts and a big old white house and a hedge-rimmed driveway going out to the street. And it was a magical kind of place for me as a kid, a place that seemed to have a lot of history in it. And I had a grandfather who was abusive to my grandmother. And so it was a kind of haunted, scary sort of place in that way also. And I think that it was inevitable I would write something there. It was inevitable it would have the mood of something like a play or a short story where it would feel very dense and in close and not a lot of chance for escape for the characters.
Well, the short story itself, when did you write that?
I wrote it over 20 years ago. It was the second one that I wrote. I have a novel coming out next year, which is actually based on the first short story I ever wrote. So I've found that 20 years later, I'm going back to what was really my richest material. These are the places and people that I care about most and the stories that I needed to tell, I think, eventually.
Was it ever published?
No, I actually lost it. I don't even have it anymore.
what was the story itself?
The story was just about the abuse, my grandfather beating my grandmother, and about how that affected my mother. And it was very close to being autobiographical. It was close to trying to understand the family history because, of course, if there's any violence in the family, there's a lot of shame and secrecy around that, and it's hard to know what the true story was. So I don't even know for sure that my grandfather ever did beat my grandmother. I was told that version for a long time, and it seems that's true. More recently, I've been told versions that it didn't happen.
So is this the murder-suicide couple?
No, that's on the other side of the family. Yeah, it was a union, a beautiful union of two families with suicides on both sides. And my grandmother, who is in this book or basis for the character, it's her mother who committed suicide in British Columbia long ago. And on my other side, my father committed suicide, and his second wife, my stepmother, lost her parents to a murder-suicide. So we've had five suicides and a murder. It's been lively.
Well, the character of Galen, it takes place, he's 22 in 1985. Why did you set it in 85? Because they didn't have cell phones?
I set it in 85 because it's the height of the New Age movement, or at least it was for me. I was very involved in the New Age in the North Bay, Santa Rosa, down to Marin County in the early 80s. And I was a true believer. Not only did I do firewalking and help with the workshops and tending the fire and meditation and relaxation workshops at lunch at school and did etheric surgery and all that, but I also tried over and over to walk on water, thinking that as I crashed into various mountain lakes and hot tubs, that this time my feet will hold. This time it will happen. I really believed it. I believed it could work. I was as psycho and as true a believer as Galen is in the book. And so that made it very fun to write.
David Vann, the New Age material that you satirize in the book includes reincarnation, various kinds of body alignment, etheric surgery, which I had never actually heard of, breathing, meditating, and virtually everything else. As the book grew, did you just start throwing things in because they were fun?
No, these were all important aspects of the New Age to me. These were parts of that religion that I focused on and studied and internalized and practiced. I did no research for the book. It was really unconscious, where each day I didn't know what the characters would do or say. And all this just came from inside me. This was all the stuff that I cared about. I was also reading Carlos Castaneda's books, Pseudoanthropology, Richard Bach's books. You know, I believed you could warm up your chocolate chip cookie by, you know, focusing on it.
Did you?
No, the chocolate chip cookie never got warm, strangely. So to me, it's interesting to write about the New Age because it's the perfect American religion, in that no one says that they're a part of it or that they're in a religion. No one in the New Age will admit that it's a religion, and yet they're all reading the same texts, thinking the same things, have the same beliefs. So it's the perfect American religion. It's the religion of the individual, a religion in which no one's a member.
And what happened to your own New Age beliefs? Did they go down with the ship, literally?
I went to college, and I was deprogrammed by two courses, a religious studies course, which was heavy in anthropological theory, and then a history of science class was the main thing that did it. In that class, I tried to defend all of this, which in history of science is called pseudoscience. By the end of that experience of writing papers in those two classes, I just couldn't believe anything anymore that I had believed before. And that was terrible, because it was so wonderful to live in an animated world in which I was the center and everything was about me, because that's what the New Age is. It's the most selfish religion there's ever been. Each person is at the center of the world, and the other people who come into their lives are teaching them a lesson, something about their own life's journey. And they've even chosen their parents and all the situations of their life. They've set up to learn these various lessons toward transcendence. So if you really believe that, then other people aren't quite real. There's only the individual in the world. And it's just like a protagonist in fiction, which is why it's so interesting to me. In fiction, everything refers to the protagonist. So when something happens in nature, if the clouds move overhead, they're saying something about the protagonist. If other characters exist in the story, they're saying something about that main character. And that's exactly what it's like to live believing New Age beliefs. You're at the center of a novel.
As you were saying that, I was thinking of the various online discussions about a show like Mad Men, where everything has meaning. The clothing has meaning.
Right.
The music has meaning.
Nothing's incidental. And it's incredibly reassuring to live in a world in which nothing is incidental, because the truth of our lives is that almost everything's incidental. Almost everything has no meaning and is pointless and purposeless. And that's terrifying to us. So if we can make meaning, if we can have it all knit up together and refer to us, to us individually, that's just a fantastic thing. So it was very sad to lose that religion.
I have a little of it left, so I'm okay with it. I kind of figure, you know, the fact is we don't know anything, you know. On the one side, we have the brain surgeons who are all atheists, because you can't be a brain surgeon and not be an atheist, apparently, you know. And on the other side, we have people who have out-of-body experiences, so I just throw the whole thing up in the air.
Yeah. The strangest thing I did that I can't explain was the firewalking. I did it many times, and I helped tend the fire. And the teacher who was giving the classes burned outrageously every night. Her feet looked like the bottom of, you know, bottom of hot dogs with the skin all puffed out. And yet she was making probably $20,000 a night, so she just kept doing it. But I was never burned, and I could feel the coals under my feet, and about maybe half or a third of the people burned and the rest didn't. And I never did figure it out why some people burned and some didn't. And I know that I was a true believer, that I was truly psycho. So if belief does do anything to help your feet not get burned, I certainly had it.
Well, I think that we know enough about the nature of mind over your body, at least sufficiently, so that, you know, you can control pain. You can control burns.
There are limits, though, of course. I had 2-year-long headaches, so I found out about the limits of controlling your pain. After a while, it just becomes who you are, and there's no escape.
Let's move on a little bit to other elements of dirt, David Vann. As you said, it's kind of a Greek tragedy. About halfway through the book, it moves inexorably to its climax. The book concerns this character of Galen. After I finished the book, I realized this guy is a manic depressive. He's got some real psychological issues, and his mother is crazy as a loon.
Yeah, no one gets off completely free in the book. And the character of Galen is based mostly on myself and also a little bit on my best friend from high school named Galen, who is someone who really helped turn my life around in that he was the first person I could tell the truth to about my father's suicide. For 3 years after his suicide when I was 13, I had told everyone that he died of cancer because I was so ashamed by it. And Galen was the first person I was able to tell the truth to. So he helped me turn a corner in my life. And the New Age movement was actually very helpful for me in trying to get over my father's suicide.
When you have that much death and destruction in your family, it almost seems necessary to come up with some kind of reason for it.
Exactly. It was finding a purpose and putting the world back together, because the strongest impression I had after my father's suicide was that the world was completely without meaning. All meaning had been knocked out of it in a single day. I didn't care about anything anymore. And so it was wonderful 3 years later, through my friend Galen and also through acting. There was a good theater program at my high school. And through the New Age movement, to put together a life that was meaningful again, that had some shape to it, some pattern and some goal. And, you know, all that was very helpful. So the character of Galen, to me, isn't crazy. And none of the characters in any of my books are crazy. Various reviews and interviewers, you know, people have felt that I write about people kind of on the edge who have gone a little far toward the dark side. But all of them make sense to me. They're consistent. The way they act comes out of their experience and as a reflection of that experience. And Galen is someone who's trying to make sense of things, but because the model he has for making sense, the New Age movement, is so far off, the kind of sense he makes ends up not making sense. So I have a line in the book that philosophy is what allows you to not bring your mother a glass of water when she's dying of thirst. And I do think that the book is largely about how ideas, how philosophy can lead to brutality, that through ideas we can lose touch with basic humanity and we can become our most monstrous and selfish versions of who we might be. So he becomes steadily distorted throughout the book.
There's a certain point where his mother calls him a monster. And he becomes a monster, but at that point he isn't a monster,
right?
Or is he?
He's not at that point. And their fight is crazy in that they don't understand each other well, and they're accusing each other of things that aren't true. And what I love about Greek tragedy is that the protagonist and antagonist, in this case Galen and his mother, are always people who are close, who love each other, who want the best for each other. But the nature of who they are, they're driving each other crazy, and they're terrible for each other, and they're going to destroy each other. And I think that is generally true of people's lives, that the people we have our strongest conflicts with are actually the people who are closest to us, who we care most about. And so Greek tragedy is interesting to me in that it's examining what goes wrong in those relationships and how do we accelerate out of control. How is it that small problems end up becoming these huge insurmountable things that lead to terrible consequences?
Well, there is one point where the mother makes a true accusation of the son. That's a terrible burden to place on any kid.
Right.
And at that point, I completely lost any sympathy I might have for that woman.
She essentially wants to keep her son at home as a kind of replacement husband. She doesn't want him to leave. She doesn't want him to go to college. And as he does something, as he acts out in a way that is actually illegal, she threatens to send him to prison for that. And it's a completely cold and unforgiving and unfair kind of judgment, which comes from her rage at being left. She doesn't want to be left. And so each character is acting out of unclear motivations, motivations they don't understand themselves.
And that includes the aunt and the aunt's
right.
daughter as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, the aunt is an engine of rage in the book. There's been favoritism in the family, and the aunt has been passed over. Galen's mother has always been favored. And so the aunt wants reparations. She wants revenge.
You're listening to an interview with David Vann, whose latest novel is Dirt. Why did you call it Dirt?
Galen finds his true meditation in dirt. He thought it would be water, like Siddhartha, that he would gaze into a stream and he would see shapes emerge in the water, and he would see the different shapes of his life and self and being, and he would gain transcendence through that. But instead, he finds his meditation as he's lifting a shovel full of dirt, and he sees the dirt rise up into the air and fling, and has that sense of it paused in the air, the kind of pattern that he finds in the grains and rocks and the beauty of the sound of it. He realizes that his true meditation has been close to him all along. It's been dirt. It's been right here in the orchard where he's spent his whole life. And that's a very exciting revelation for him. It's in extreme contrast to what's going on for his mother at that moment. And that, to me, is where a lot of the charge in the book comes from, is the contrast between what's actually happening and what Galen believes is happening as we get toward the end. He thinks he's getting closer to transcendence. Meanwhile, something very different is going on for his mother.
David Vann, you've made a couple of comments. There is no inherent meaning in landscape, particularly mm-hmm. in a novel. Landscape is just a giant mirror, and we give it whatever meaning we want. That goes up against an interview I did with an Appalachian writer named Ron Rash.
I know him. He's great.
He is great. And he talks about the absolute importance of the role landscape plays in people. Now, you make this comment, yet your work, your earlier fiction that's been published, this book, and your nonfiction are all about landscape. In this, it's the landscape of the dry, very dry California Central Valley. In Caribou Island and Legend of a Suicide, it's the landscape of Alaska, mostly in winter and some in summer. And your nonfiction book, A Mile Down, is all about a different landscape, which is the sea. Mm-hmm. And yet you say landscape is unimportant.
Oh, I didn't say it's unimportant. I said it has no meaning, no meaning of its own, no inherent meaning. I actually agree probably with what Ron Rash is saying, that landscape shapes people in a vitally important way. And it's impossible to imagine people in their stories without the landscape around them that shaped them. But any meaning in that landscape is created by the people, is given by the people to the land. So in this book, when dirt becomes so important to Galen, that's his sense of the landscape. The truth is that the dirt is just dirt, and he runs into problems whenever the dirt seems like just dirt. That's disappointing to him.
In the same level, do you think you could just transport the entire story into the wilds of Alaska with the same meanings?
No, it would become a completely different story.
Well,
he wouldn't be shaped in the same way by the landscape, but the dirt still means nothing on its own. That's the thing. Dirt has no inherent meaning. No landscape has any inherent meaning. This is why we can make whatever we want of the landscapes. This is how we can have romantic visions of frontier and wilderness and imagine our goodness and our resourcefulness there. And this is why we can have Sarah Palin claim that Alaska equals conservative family values. She's placing that meaning on the landscape. It's not a meaning the landscape has by itself. It may force people to be more resourceful to be up there, but it certainly doesn't force them to be good or to be better than they were before. That's a judgment that's been added. And for Galen, this landscape becomes hellish in some ways. It's hot, burning, but the hellish part would be what a human is reading into it. It's a reflection of the interior landscape. When it seems exciting and possible and there's an opening into transcendence through meditation on dirt, that's again something that indicates the inside life of the character.
As I'm reading the book, I'm feeling the oppressive heat. Mm-hmm. So the heat is playing a role, just as in Caribou Island, the cold is playing a role, just as in your nonfiction book, the storm is playing a role because your ship went down.
Right. And I focus on landscape in all of these. I mean, it's each day as I'm writing, where I focus is there are only two things that I trust. I trust landscape, and I trust a problem in the main character. And I don't trust plot or ideas, anything else. So I'm just trying to see the place, and I'm trying to see this orchard through Galen's eyes. So I'm trying to see the place through the problem in the main character. And that's my only point of focus as I'm going along writing it. So the landscape does have this incredible impact on the character. But any meaning, this is the important point, is that any meaning is created out of the inner landscape of the character and is placed on the external landscape.
When you were writing the book, you said you had no idea where it was going or how it would get there. But it struck me, as reading it at least, that at least the first draft must have gone very quickly.
The final published version of the book is the first draft. I only added two or three paragraphs.
Okay.
You get to read exactly the same thing that I saw. And I had no idea that it would end where it does or that that second half would be at all like that. I really, when I started out, I started on the first page and had no idea what page two would be. And the reason I focus so much on landscape is that the landscape, I think, is a place for the unconscious to work. It's a kind of blank page for the unconscious. So I'm finding out not just the inside life of Galen, but also the inside life my own inside life. And there's all this pattern. The most incredible thing to me about writing, the single most incredible thing, is that there's all of this pattern and meaning without any idea or plan or outline. That it manages to be in there anyway, that our unconscious is essentially patterned.
So you wrote the scene between Galen and Jennifer not knowing at that point that it was like a gun in a handbag and the gun would be pulled out.
Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't know if they would sleep together or not. I had no idea when it started. There was the tease. There was his unbearable feeling of having taken peeks at her for 4 years and trying to avoid that because it's his cousin. And this is part of how he's caught up in samsara, something he wants to be freed from. And that's all I knew when I wrote that scene.
David Vann, how do you build a boat in Turkey?
Well, just as my writing is unconscious and without shape or plan ahead of time, I actually lived my life that way. And when I was building a boat in Turkey, it was actually someone else was building it for me. And then later, as I built my own boats, I didn't have as much plan as I should have had. And I hit a lot of disasters. To me, everything in my life has been similar and connected. There's been a kind of strange pattern to it in that the writing is unconscious and I discover each page as I go along. I did theater in high school that was improv theater where it wasn't scripted and we didn't have set gestures and where we'd be standing on stage. It was something that was supposed to come out of whatever the interactions were between the characters. I've made important choices that have changed the shape of my life that in retrospect I haven't understood at the time that have been completely unconscious. I went to sea to repeat my father's life really to get closer to his disasters and who he was without understanding that at the time. I got married, and I still can't say exactly why I did. I just know that I did. You know, really, everything has been like that for me, and it's been both good and bad. In the writing, it's very exciting. In real life, it's terrifying to not know what you're doing.
When you were building these boats, did you have a plan? You don't just say, I want some wood, I'm going to build a boat.
I always had a plan, and then the plan never worked. I did careful budgets when I built a boat, for instance, and I had every little item in a spreadsheet, you know, every little nail and screw and, the whole bit. And somehow the boats always cost twice as much as what that budget said. And I have no idea. It's still a mystery to me how it is that it moved from the budget to what it became. And the shape of the boat itself, I would imagine one thing, and I can imagine shapes ahead of time and walk through them, and it did end up being that. But there'd be flaws in the boat which were not things that I could see, not things that I could imagine.
Like what?
Well, for instance, in building a big 90-foot aluminum catamaran using integral tanks where the tanks are welded right into the hulls, they're aluminum, and not knowing ahead of time, not having any experience with aluminum welding, not knowing that it's very hard not to have some tiny little pinhole somewhere, and that integral tanks are into the hull are such a terrible idea. It never dripped externally, but within the boat, it leaked from the fuel section into the next section. There'd be little seepage, and it was just seepage that was impossible to ever eliminate. Understanding that when something takes shape, you have a certain vision of how things will be, but then when it takes shape, it's much more complicated. It has a different life. And this is true in writing, too. Characters take on a different kind of life and have different sort of problems than you imagine at first. And that's what I mean about not knowing what the book's going to be about at the end, not knowing what the meaning will be, the significance of it. I actually don't know that when I start on page one. I'm discovering what all this will be. When I said, for instance, that Dirt is about philosophy leading to brutality, that's an abstraction that I only could have come up with later and looked back on. It would have been terrible to try to write a book that would be about that idea. It's only through discovery that that idea could work, that you could find out that, wow, he's done all this crazy stuff, driven by ideas, thinking he's one thing and doing one thing, but actually it's something else. Only after you experience that gap through all these scenes could you come to the conclusion philosophy can lead to brutality.
As you were talking, I suddenly thought about the way fundamentalist Christians, their philosophy leads to murder and brutality.
Yeah, and philosophy and religion always has led to incredible brutality. That's actually been one of the major effects of systems of thought, is to enable individuals and groups of people to brutalize each other.
Why do you think that is?
I think we want to brutalize, and we're looking for justification. The ideas are a cheap trick, a way to get there and to feel good about ourselves. Because really, it's not that hard for us to convince ourselves to do things that we want to do that actually we know we shouldn't do. That's a very easy line for us to cross, and we only need an idea to help us get there.
That's a pretty strong philosophy you've got right now, David Vann. I suspect that in 10 years it might change.
It's always changing, yeah. With each book, I find out something different. I actually understand these books slowly over time as I do interviews in different countries. They're all coming out in 18 languages, about 20 or 30 countries. And in each different country, interviewers will have a slightly different take. Like an interview in France will be asking me different sorts of questions. And I get knocked off guard by that. And because of that, I start to understand something new about the book.
For Caribou Island, what did they ask you, say, in France or Switzerland that they would never have asked you here?
They asked me about Rhoda, who's the good person in the book, and I had given her that name because she was supposed to be based on my stepmother, my father's second wife.
Right.
But it turns out she's actually based on my sister, and I hadn't realized that at all, that my sister is the good one in our family. She's the one who always worries what's going to happen to other people and wants the best and is incredibly generous, and it's just that way by nature. And I didn't realize that I was writing about her. I had no idea. And I even misnamed her in the book, thinking I wanted to give the tag of Rhoda, recognizing that it would be material for my stepmother. It can be very personal things like that, realizing the source materials for the book. It can also be looking at pattern and meaning. One French interviewer made me realize how many biblical allusions there were in the opening of Suquan Island, the novella within Legend of a Suicide. It starts with a kind of creation myth, but then throughout the rest of the story, there are patterns also that I hadn't seen before. I honestly had not understood. So I do have this happen over and over, that I understand the books and the process of writing and myself better. Each culture has its own demons. When we look to tragedy, we want to test whether we're good or bad, and we especially want to know the shape of our badness. And so in each country I go to, they'll give me the shape of their badness in the interview. They'll give me their own kind of demons, the ways in which they don't like themselves or they fear themselves. And they'll give me questions which are reflections of that, which are in some way mirrored in my book. Some commonality of experience we have where there was something I did in a scene that resonates in some way for them and brings up some aspect of their own problems.
Well, what did interviewers in Alaska ask you about Caribou Island?
Alaskans have been incredibly generous to me, considering that I wrote two books that have fairly dim views of Alaska. And what's great to me about Alaska is that they fully acknowledge their darkness. They're very unlike other Americans in that way. They understand that they have the highest suicide rate in the nation, that they have a lot of young suicides. In Ketchikan, where I was giving a reading where I spent my childhood, they just had a rash of them, kind of copycat suicides, three or four teenagers. And they find that really frightening, and they want to understand what's going on here, what's going wrong. They also understand they have the highest gun ownership in the nation, and so they understand firsthand that guns don't, in fact, make us safer in our homes. They also have felt the economic pinch in various ways. They're at the forefront of effects of climate change. They're going to have to spend like $50 billion in redoing highways and bridges that are all sinking. So they're not able to deny things in the same way that others in the U.S. are. Others in the U.S. can deny that climate change even exists. Even conservatives in Alaska have to admit that it exists because they see the road sinking.
But they're still electing people like Sarah Palin.
Well, Sarah Palin, before she became famous to the rest of us, actually was more moderate. She had gotten several important pieces of legislation passed in Alaska that were supported by Democrats also. She was not as polarizing a figure as we think of her now. So once she went on to the national stage, then all Democrats in Alaska did begin to hate her, and some Republicans too, and felt that she misrepresented the state, and she also crapped out on her responsibilities as the governor, so people weren't happy about that. But before that, she was actually a lot more popular, and she was more moderate, and she was working more with other people, and she wasn't as openly insane in her beliefs.
Well, I remember off the air at one point we were talking, and you made the comment that you have all these right-wingers who sit around and smoke dope.
Yeah, Alaska's a land of strange contrasts. People on the far left and far right who behave in oddly similar ways at times. It is a funny place in that way. And it's a place where you can rethink what America is and who Americans are.
Right now, I guess they have one Democratic senator and one independent. To that extent, is Alaska kind of changing?
I think so. I think things have gone badly enough for long enough that there's a desire to pull out of some of the problems. But It's more divided as a state, the population, than the general polarization throughout the U.S. It's probably more divided than that. So it's still very hard to say what an Alaskan is. You'd have to talk about what several different Alaskans are.
A lot of evangelicals up there?
Yeah. Whoever is kind of extreme on the fringe to the right or left finds a kind of haven in Alaska because you can form your own sort of enclaves there. Over time, this has been actually from other countries. There are Russians there, there are Norwegians, there's a large native population. But there are also sort of small cult movements and certainly a strong evangelical presence. Anchorage is a large military town, and because of that, it's conservative and religious. Yeah, there's kind of everyone up there.
David Vann, you mentioned that your new book, the one you're working on now, that one is also Greek tragedy?
That's right. It's Goat Mountain. It's set in Northern California, a couple hours north of Lakeport, and it's the hunting ranch that my family went to every fall, where we'd hunt deer. And when we'd go to that ranch each time, my father and uncle and grandfather would tell the stories of what had happened over all the years, who had been there and what deer had been shot or missed. And so our whole family history was in a place. And the first short story I ever wrote was set there. So it seems inevitable that I would end up writing something there. But what happens in the book is that in real life, my father would have me aim at poachers through the scope of his 300 Magnum rifle and with a shell in the chamber and the safety off. So I'd be looking at these guys through the crosshairs where if I pulled the trigger, they'd be dead. And in the first chapter of the book, the boy pulls the trigger. And that causes problems for his father and his grandfather and his father's friend. And the antagonist in the book is his grandfather, who becomes a kind of god in the book, a very strange sort of figure. So it's very exciting to me because it gets actually closest to Greek tragedy, even closer than Dirt. It's just one location, a mountainside, with no human structures or other people. There's only four characters. It happens in just 2.5 days, a hunting trip gone awry. And it's all told through that landscape, which becomes even more hot and burning and hellish than this one in Dirt.
Have you thought about turning Dirt into a play?
I haven't really. The main reason is that I work through landscape. That's the primary way that I work. And in a play, you don't get to have any of the landscape. It's completely ripped out. So although the dramatic structure is the same as a play, the entire surface of my book is different than a play could possibly be. You can never have this kind of discussion of landscape in a play.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, it's imagination is imagination.
I don't think there's any way. I think that the internal vision of the character is something that you just can't offer in a play, and especially that vision as articulated through how the landscape warps and changes. You can't have any warping and changing on stage. It's the influence that I have for dramatic structure, but it's a much more limited form, finally. In both books, there's lots of the stuff that would make scenes in a play. And you could still – I actually have co-written the screenplay for Caribou Island with a director, Bill Guttentag, who's wonderful director, has won 2 Academy Awards. And we just did a read-through in L.A. with actors and actresses. And it was wonderful to hear all those scenes read aloud and to feel the impact by the end, that everything's happening in a shorter period of time than reading a book. And there's more impact of the fights between them by the end. But what's missing is all that description of landscape, the sense of internal vision of the characters. So what happens is you don't know the people as well. In a movie or a play, you actually don't know these characters as well as you would in a book. But you feel the punch of what happens more immediately, and there's something very exciting about that. So I loved seeing it in the screenplay form read aloud by actors. But it is just a different piece at that point.
Well, of course, at that point, it's a collaborative effort. Each of the actors, not to mention the director, the lighting design and sound and everything else, each of the actors has to bring their own role.
Right.
No matter who you would cast for someone like Galen, it would be their role.
Right. They would take it over and they would change it. And I loved that, actually, hearing the actors read. I mean, it was very exciting to me to see the characters take shape in a little different way than I had imagined them and see them come to life in their own way.
How close is that to being actually made into a film?
We're hoping to film as early as September. We're putting together the funding, or June next year. So I really think we're going to make it. And Bill Guttentag is just a fantastic director, so I'm very excited about the project.
What has he direct?
His new one is called Knife Fight with Rob Lowe, and it was just shown at Tribeca, and it'll come out in the fall. And it's a great film. It's so funny.
So is Caribou Island going to be filmed up in on location?
Right. It'll be actually filmed in Alaska, Skelak Lake on the Kenai Peninsula, right where it's set, Caribou Island.
One more question about Goat Mountain. Was the writing similar to this? In fact, you know, you started and you're going through and now you're looking and going, and I not going to do much editing either?
Yeah, it has no editing. Absolutely zero. Caribou Island had 7 or 8 paragraphs added. Dirt had 2 or 3 paragraphs added. And Goat Mountain has nothing added. Nothing cut, nothing changed. It's absolutely going to be published with no comments from my agent or my editor in exactly the version that I finished in 5.5 months.
And that would include even the smallest kinds of word edits, word changes?
As I was going through in the 5.5 months, I read through the whole manuscript every 2 weeks, and I would make small line edits. I mean, but very small, and I didn't actually make them very often. All the sentences pretty much are the way they just came out right away. I mean, maybe there's 1,000 words of line editing,
right?
You know, where I'm cutting little bits, mostly grammatical morphemes, the little crappy little things that hold sentences together that we don't actually need.
Have you thought about doing more short stories?
No, I haven't thought of doing short stories at all for a long time. I'm really loving novels. I mean, there's a compression to Dirt, which can feel a little bit like a short story, but it gets to develop over a much longer time. There's a whole second half to it that's very different than the first half. You know, there's a different kind of development that's much more satisfying to me than a short story, so I don't think I'll go back.
You've been listening to an interview with David Vann, whose latest novel is Dirt. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.